The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Oil plunges. Market indices get smacked. Bitcoin crashes. And a heap of listener questions. All this and much more on episode number 589 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And what's happening out there? It's Andrew Horowitz, and I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you for joining me today on this holiday-shortened week with Thanksgiving smack in the middle of it. Hopefully you enjoyed some great turkey and some friends and family. I had each and every year we go to a family member's house, and they do just an incredible job of filling multiple tables of food. It's actually more tables full of food than there is for seating. But each and every year, one of the things they do and they specialize in is creating this glorious turducken, which if you haven't had it yet, it's about time you look into this. It's a duck stuffed into a chicken, stuffed into a turkey, and all of that is stuffed with great stuffing, traditional stuffing, and baked off and tied off and juicy and delicious. So if you haven't had that, it's pretty cool. We had a regular turkey as well, and we had, you know, the green beans, and we had the potatoes and the sweet potatoes and yams, and just went on and on. Not to mention, of course, the appetizers that, you know, you eat all those and how do you even eat the rest of the meal? But we managed, we tried to get as much done as we could. I give us a good effort. A minus. I wasn't like really stuffed afterwards. I don't know. Sometimes after Thanksgiving, you're just like, oh, you go into like a food coma. I didn't have that this year. I ate. I felt good. It was reasonable. And that was it. But hopefully, again, you did in fact enjoy not only your Thanksgiving, but all the leftovers that you have right now that you're probably eating for the next couple of days. You got turkey sandwiches, turkey omelets, turkey casserole, turkey mac and cheese, all sorts of things that you're going to use for, you know, with turkey. So hopefully that all worked out well for you. It did not work out as well last week for markets. If you've been watching what's been going on, there seems to be this continuation of this, you know, it's more than a consolidation. It's a downtrend, and pretty much a heavy downtrend now where every rally seems to be sold. A couple of rallies in between here and there, a day, 2 days, but then it's sold off. And we saw the same thing happen this week as well. Of course, the holiday shortened week, Wednesday markets were open. There was some good volume there. Thursday markets were closed, and Friday markets were only open for a half day until 1 p.m. But the rest of the world was open, and there was a good amount of news. I thought it was interesting that the Brexit announcement of a leaked document that discusses the items, the wish list, the foundation, the framework of items was released on Thanksgiving, kind of a breakup of England from the rest of the rest of the EU area, and it kind of was oddly done on Thanksgiving. I thought that was a little bit weird, possibly a little bit mean. But the S&P fell about 3.8% for the week, and again, that was in a pretty shortened week. And now that took the performance down for the S&P 500 down below the zero line into the red for the year. The Dow Jones Industrial had a really rough week, down 4.4%. The NASDAQ lost 4.3%. The Russell was the one that didn't do as badly, but in fact did pretty badly also, down 2.6%. On a relative basis, like, oh, well, it was 2% better than the others. Now, the one thing that I noticed that I thought was something we should talk about here was the fact that over the last number of days, maybe I would say since last Friday, so a week ago, there was a noticeable change in the type of selling. Now, you probably heard this from time to time, this whole idea of, well, it was a panic selling, or it was an orderly selling, or is it panic buying? So for the last couple of weeks, I've noticed that this selling was relatively, I would say, tough on many occasions, but somewhat orderly, just ticking down and selling and ticking down and selling. And, you know, that's kind of the routine that we saw over the last several weeks. Well, this week, it seemed a little bit more throwing the baby out with the bathwater. In fact, on Monday, and to a degree on Tuesday, but there was in this week, on the opening of the markets, there was some incredible gap downs, looking like there was just a sell order on open. So a sell to open on the market at any price. Like people said, okay, I don't care what the price is. When the market opens, I'm just done. I'm finished. I want out of this. And that's where you get some of this disorderly selling, where you see these gap downs, because now all these orders come in. There's really maybe no limit. People are throwing it out just as a market order. And then whatever price is, you know, is notched at that level is what they get. And we saw these big, and I would say very significant gap downs on open, which were recovered somewhat throughout the day. But it was a little bit rough. These openings now that have any type of these gapping lower of individual names is something to take notice of, because that is a sign of disorderly selling. It's a sign of panic, sign of people desiring to get out at any price. And that's not a normal sell process where you're seeing a market that's in correction mode. It gets to that towards the end of something, towards the end of a cycle, or it could be when it's just upcoming into an event where people say, the hell with this, I want out, I don't want any risk, I want this cleaned out of my portfolio, I'm done. You've had this, I'm sure you've had this, where you're like, okay, the stock's moving down, and it's going down, you're like, okay, I'm holding, fine, I'm holding, you know. Moving down, you get some news, maybe it moves up a little bit, then moves down, you're like, oh, well, and your emotions start to really get thrown around both sides, you know, when it's starting to move up and down, starts to move up again, you're like, okay, finally, yeah, I was right, I'm holding on to this thing, I'm not getting rid of this. And then maybe it gets a little bit below the level that you said that you were going to sell. So maybe let's just pick a number. You're like, okay, I bought this thing at $12.50. It's now at $11.50. I'm okay. My line in the sand is 10. Starts to move down slowly and orderly, right? Slowly and orderly. And now it's getting towards about 10.60 and 10.50. Now it's at 10.25. Now it gets to 10. And you're like, you know what? I don't want to sell it here. Okay, this is all the emotional and psychological that goes on when we talk about stocks, talk about money. Like, maybe I'll buy some more, in fact. So what you do is the market starts to move up all of a sudden, and you're like, you know what? I knew it. That was the bottom. I knew that was the bottom. That was the bottom. And what do? You buy a little bit more. You kind of say, I'm going to average down a little bit here. My line in the stand still is about 10, but, you know, it's at 10.50, 10.60, 10.70. Starts moving up. You're like, I'm buying. Now, all of a sudden, what happens is that reverses. Now you're like, oh my God, I made a mistake. You think to yourself, you were so sure of yourself yesterday, but now all of a sudden today, oh man, I'm making a mistake. Again, this is the psychology of the markets and something you need to be aware of if you're trading, if you're investing. And you have to decide, by the way, am I a trader? Am I an investor? Am I holding this for a long time? And if so, are there rules that I'm putting into place that I am going to stand by? So now what you have is a stock that's coming down. It's correcting significantly. It's getting towards the levels that you built as a line in the sand. And now all of a sudden, $10.15 is here. And you're thinking, all right, well, I have that line in the sand at 10.15. And it starts going down a little bit. They're going down a little bit more. So all of a sudden, it cracks that $10 level. And you're thinking, okay, that was my line. But man, I don't want to sell it down here. I'm going to take too much of a loss. I added to it when it was like 10.50 now. Maybe I'll hold a little bit longer. So now it gets to about 9.70, 9.60. And then you kind of, the market closes. You're like, okay, the market's closed. That's it. Good. I'm at a low. I'm done. And then you start seeing that there's maybe some news item, or maybe there's something else going on with the markets. And you finally decide you can't take it anymore. And you put an order, you're like, I am out of this stock. I am not willing to take any more losses on this. I am selling it at whatever the price is. I am done. and you put in an order to sell at the market, maybe the next day upon open. And not only you, but a lot of others have done the same thing. They've kind of gotten to a point that they are just, their guts have been ripped out by this. They can't take it anymore. They're panicked. They think that, man, this thing is obviously going to zero. So all of a sudden you get a tremendous amount of sell orders that come in, knocks the bid down significantly, and you get maybe sold out at $9.20. It closed the day before, let's call it, at $9.60. So you just took another 4 or 5% loss on it overnight. You're like, phew, man, am I happy I'm out of that. Not realizing that maybe the play was to wait a few minutes into the open of the day, see how things play out, next to 5 or 10 cents either direction, who cares? And lo and behold, yep, you were stopped out, or you took it out at the low or near the recent low. So here's the point of all this. Number one, if you have a plan of action, you have to stick to it. I've talked about this a long time ago, many, many times. I don't think I've brought it up recently, but it's a good time to do it because we're getting towards the end of the year, the beginning of a new year, where we do our best to kind of set up all look back at all the things that we've done wrong, set up all the things we're going to do right. It's a new year. It's a fresh start. You know, I'm going to make these resolutions. I'm going to play the game like it's supposed to be played. If in fact your line in the sand, for whatever reason, whether it was a technical level, whether it was just a pain point level in terms of the amount of money you were willing to lose, is $10, sell it at $10. If the stock's moving down, like we said, at 1070, 1060, decide to buy more. Think about, well, if I buy more, how is that going to increase my overall tension level if it starts to fall? And is that something I want to do? Am I just so excited about, oh my God, I better get in, you know, the FOMO. Oh man, if it starts to move up from here, man, oh, I should have bought more at the low. Is that a wise thing to do? Are you just being persuaded by the general market direction and being sucked in by what actually is a false move higher? Stick by your rules. And one of the ways you can do that is setting up stop limits. Not selling on the open. Not reacting, but being proactive. So think about that. Don't get caught up in the emotional aspect of what's going on, rather than, you know, try to be somewhat, you have to have some emotion, of course, because that helps you at times, but you also have to be sticking by your rules. Stay by what you said you were going to do, what the line in the sand is, either on a buy or a sell, a short or a cover. Stand by that. If you're only going to buy breakouts, well, that's what your plan is for whatever reason. Don't buy falling knives. If you're going to be looking at only, you know, saying that I'm going to buy dips, well, then don't buy breakouts. Whatever your plan is, stay by the plan and you'll see how that works out. So now let's go back to the markets for a second and talk a little bit about how I see this current market condition. There's a few indicators that I saw this week that I thought were really interesting. I thought there was something that you should understand more in terms of overall market setups and whether or not we are in a orderly buying or selling scenario, or whether or not there is some panic entering. Now, you've seen some of the old adages, right? You know, buy when there's blood in the street. That sometimes works if you have a long enough horizon. If you're only doing short-term trades, that may or may not work depending on how much blood is actually out there. But there's a couple of key measures that I'd like to look at that helps me understand the mood of the markets. Of course, if they're selling and there's a 3% drop in a day, the mood is pretty negative. That's obvious. But really, what I really want to look at is the internals and understand more about what's happening and the skewedness, the speed at which, the panic sense, the, you know, what is going on really with the markets that can give me a clue as to, are we closer to a bottom and something that may be a buyable bottom, or are we continuing on with this for some time? Now, I got to state one point that I think is really important. Market corrections and market rallies. Market rallies that go on for a long period of time, where you see a lot of these indicators that are flashing overbought situations, may or may not be, I would say, completely accurate on a short-term basis. You have to watch the trend of what's happening. Overbought markets can stay overbought for a long period of time. As you know, that I've said many times before, that people and the majority of investors will be buyers rather than sellers most of the time. Therefore, when you get into an overbought situation where markets are screaming higher, a lot of investors will chase it very much more than they will on a market that's dropping, just outright selling. Because you have a few things that are going on there. Number one, the proclivity of investors is to buy and to be invested, and that's what they do. You have 401k plans, sovereign wealth funds, you have pension plans, you have just all sorts of different areas of the investment world that are continuing to actually put money into markets regardless of the market conditions. So again, that leads us to believe that there is more of a chance that markets on the upside will continue to flow higher because of chasing it and the standard buying, not to mention corporate buybacks, than on a dip. They're much more short-lived. Corrections are much more vertically aligned rather than a smooth and eloquent process moving higher over time. They move much more quickly through time and then resolve. So here's a few measures that I want to look at, that just a couple of them that I think are interesting and something that you should look at also, because these give us an eye towards how much panic is in the market, and maybe that is a sign that there's something to look at more further in terms of the potential for looking at dipping your toes in and maybe buying on some dips short term and taking advantage of the opportunity of a severely oversold situation and a panic situation. So there's something known as the TRIN, T-R-I-N. Now, this spiked in near three on Friday. On Friday, we saw a pretty good spike, even though it was a holiday-shortened day. And last time it was this high, I looked back and it was in the middle of August, the 15th of August. And at that day, the market did in fact see an intermediate bottom, spiked higher for a couple of months after that. Now, this is a contrary indicator. When you see it high, it means that there's some panic. And I personally like to look at over the level of 2 on a consistent basis, not just a quick pop, but a 2 that has been kind of growing towards that level, a plus 2, to see if there's actually panic in the markets. And 0.5 is the bottom. So 0.5 are deemed to be oversold. 0.5 is to be overbought. So the lower it's contrary. 0.5 is overbought. And over a 3, generally by, especially a surge over 3, is deemed to be oversold. Again, I look at plus 2 and plus 0.5, but okay, it depends on how you want to look at it. Technically, if you look at it by the indicator, the gentleman who put it together, it's a surge over plus 3. Now, I'm going to give you a definition of this from stockcharts.com, which I think did a pretty good job of this, and this is the TRIN indicator, which is also known as the short-term trading index. That's the T-R-I-N in trading index. It's also known as the ARMS index, and it was developed by the gentleman named Richard ARMS in 1967. And the way they calculate this index is by dividing the advanced decline ratio by the advanced decline volume ratio. And typically, these breadth statistics are derived from the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ index, but the ARMS index, it can be calculated using breadth statistics from other indices like the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, the small caps, whatever you want. Because it acts as an oscillator, the indicator is often used to identify short-term overbought or oversold conditions. And you can also put a moving average on this to smooth it out a little bit. So what this is looking at really is advanced decline line and advanced decline volume. So technically what we're really looking at is the amount of advancers or decliners by volume in a ratio standpoint. So it's the advanced decline volume ratio and the advanced decline ratio. So how many advancers, decliners, how many advanced decliners by volume on a ratio basis. And then you look at that and you calculate it, and that's how you come up with a formation. So if you think about what's going on right here, what this index is really truly doing is measuring the downside volume pressure in a corrective market, a sell-off, or the upside volume level on a ratio basis on the advanced decliners, right? How many advancers and what's the volume? And if you see good amounts of volume on advancing, and again, this is again ratio form. I'm just giving you the quick and dirty here. But if you see the advancers on good volume, it's kind of showing you that there is a good overall buy signal generated until you get to a point that it's too much. Until like everything is hitting the advancers at high volumes, everybody's in the pool, everybody's buying. Then it becomes a contrarian indicator. But again, I like to look at this more so on the downside, because if we just discussed and agreed that downside action and corrective action happens quickly through time, that's why if you ever look at a chart, rallies happen over time very smoothly often, a couple of spikes here and there, but corrections happen vertically, quickly through time. And if that is the case, you want to be able to find out somewhat when that panic strikes, where people are just saying, all right, the hell with this, I'm out. And maybe you flush out a good amount of the selling, and then what's left? If a lot of the selling is gone, and we know that we discussed that there is consistent buying that goes on from sovereign wealth funds and 401k plans and buybacks and people just, you know, reinvesting on a regular basis and putting money in on a dollar cost averaging basis. Hello? We know there's going to be a nice potential for the buying to start picking up. And therefore, potentially, that bottom has been reached and the average buyers are still buying in as they always would. Now, another indicator to look at is the put-call ratio. It essentially shows the number of puts versus calls being bought on a comparative basis. Now, if we have over one, what that tells us is that there are more puts being bought than calls. So it's the put slash call ratio. So the put is the numerator, the number of puts are the numerator, and the denominator is the calls. So what we have here is that if you see a number that is moving higher than one, people are looking to buy protection. And if it spikes dramatically, you know that panic is out there. Now, oftentimes you see this in the 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, a lot more calls being bought than puts. Over one is a demarcation point. Now you start to look at over one, a lot more puts are being bought here. And there's some other reasons that we look at this. It has to do with not only protection, but protection when you're buying. You could have a market sell-off with a put-call ratio below one. And that's probably signs of a continuation of a market decline because people aren't looking to protect. They're looking to just sell out. When people are looking to protect and that put-call ratio gets really high, it's actually another contrarian indicator that says that, you know what? Maybe people are starting to put their money back into the markets and what they want to do is they're stopping selling and they're buying puts as protection. So when we see that put-call ratio spike Friday, it was anywhere from 1.1 to 1.35 during the day. It looks like investors are now looking to protect positions, possibly over the weekend, because it's a long weekend. Or maybe it's reached a point that they're done with their selling and now they're just looking to protect their portfolios at this point. And oftentimes what happens is when you get to the level where their put-call ratio is over 1.1, 1.2, that could be a turning point for the markets. Now, I'm not suggesting that either of these happen instantaneously, especially with what we have coming up next week. And we'll talk about that in a second because a lot of news happening. There's a lot of things that are going on in the markets right now, the news headlines that are flowing very regularly that could be causing some angst and reason for people to go out and buy protection, sell down their portfolio positions, bring down their equity exposure overall. And that may be, you know, something that we're seeing that is news driven. So there's a lot of things that go into play with all of this here, right? But there's something that I like to look at to find out a little bit more information, just that little additional ounce of indication of where we are with the fear, the panic, and the level of concern in the markets rather than the complacency. So clearly, if we look at these indices last week, the two of them that I'm talking about right now, it seems that complacency is kind of making way for some panic. And once you get to those and that blowout capitulation point where people just say, hey, I'm selling at any cost, and we see those gap downs on the open where people just flush out their positions, we see the put call ratio above one significantly, and we see the trend ratio or the trend index move up well above two and into the threes. You got to start saying we could be closer to a bottoming process here, at least an intermediate or a short-term bottoming process, than we are away from it. So what does this all mean now? Let's bring this all together. We talked about the first part of the gap downs, people selling out with that, just saying, get me out of the stock. I'm done. We saw those gap outs last week on a couple of days. We saw latter part of the week, the trend ratio spike. We saw the put call ratio spike, contrarian indicators. And there could be some reasons for this. Let's talk about that. So we have a holiday shortened week. So volume slowed down as the week progressed, and maybe there was some excess volatility in the markets, and liquidity was sapped out of the markets, so any kind of selling was really exacerbated. We have something big happening next week, and it could be a sign of worry right now, which actually I like. I like the fact that we're pretty negative on the outcome of the G20 meeting for next week. I know this sounds kind of weird, and I'm not trying to be, you know, really bullish here on this, but you know, when you get down to these levels in the market, there are some great opportunities to buy on the lows, at least for a temporary reversal, and then short back into it. But there's a lot of worries going to the G20 that nothing will get done, and the meetings between President Trump and President Xi are going to reveal absolutely no new information. There'll be no movement, there'll be nothing done, and then we're getting into the end of the year where more tariffs will be applied to China. And the situation just could theoretically go on infinitum. And clearly this G20, which is happening next Friday and Saturday, have investors on edge. And no wonder why the potential is for some investors to be possibly picking up some puts to protect their portfolio, selling out in advance, saying, the hell with this, I'm done. We saw recent retail sales reports from companies have been pretty unimpressive. If you look at the earnings reports the last couple of weeks from retail, generally speaking, a couple of outliers, pretty ugly. Stocks got hammered on the outlook. Their numbers weren't so bad, but the outlook and combined with their same-store sales and the margins, not the prettiest thing we've ever seen. So we saw a lot of these companies just get smashed pretty good after a pretty good run at the beginning of the year. The housing market, durable goods, and sentiment indicators that came out this week, generally falling. That's leading to worries about the potential for some kind of an economic slowdown. Now, I'm not talking about a recession necessarily right now, but there is now all of a sudden more and more worries that are entering into the market about the potential for recession due to the fact that we're seeing a slowdown in the rest of the world, tariffs that are hurting us here and globally, as well as a higher interest rate environment that is being pushed on us by the Fed. So now the potential for a recession in, let's say, the next year, which has not been predicted and put into the models by most analysts, are starting to creep in the discussion. And as that happens, they have to adjust their models, their earnings outlook. And all of a sudden, that's why you see price earnings ratios contracting. So while we still see that, hey, nothing's changed in the earnings model recently, per se, from companies, couple of, you know, more and more companies are guiding lower, but still to a point that's not so bad. But why are we seeing stock prices drop so much? It's a function of the unwillingness of people to buy into the fact that there is going to be continued growth. And if a recession does come, you have to change your whole formulation of how you value stocks, kick down the earnings multiple into the future. And that, of course, reduces the price of the stock, at least the analyst expectations for the price of the stock. And then that flows into the average investor not willing to take on that risk. Now, we saw crude oil in a free fall. A lot of people say, well, that's good, right? I mean, it's good. Oil falling down in price, that means I'm going to pay less at the pump. If I'm going to pay less at the pump, everybody else is paying less at the pump, and then there's more money to spend. Yes and no. It is true that while oil prices fall at the pump, down 12 cents last week, probably another 12 cents this week, 14 cents maybe this week, we saw a pretty significant slide. Oil's down right above the $50 line for WTI crude, down 7% just on Friday alone. The truth is, it is good for the individual consumer, and it's kind of like a tax cut. Yeah, I agree with that. However, it's also a cut to earnings for a component of the S&P 500 that has just recently recovered from years in the doghouse. So with oil falling in prices, you also have a drop to the potential for S&P 500 earnings estimates into the future, which will therefore bring down overall pricing estimations. And when you have a PE contracting, that doesn't help. There's also some worry recently that's starting to pop up around that this year-end Santa Claus rally that we see each year, sort of in November through the end of December, and already we're halfway plus through November, and that is not happening. It's not going to appear as hoped for. Some of that's good. Some of these things that go into the market, that there's this wall of worry and concern, is a good thing, because now all of a sudden people don't know what to do, but they start to all of a sudden turn around very quickly. Once you get all of the negative news out there, the thought is, well, if there's no more negative news, any incremental positive news will be really good. So here we are in a situation where there's a long list that I'm not finished with yet about all the potential worries that are going on. So any incremental positive here could be very good. If we see something that somehow is generated from the G20, that could be really good for markets. Heading into it, there's going to be a brick wall of worry that we're going to get into. And if we don't see the housing market pick up, although we saw a little bit better numbers last week, or if we see the GDP number come in this week, expectations are for it to get a 3.6%, I believe it is, from 3.5. Okay, well, maybe if there's a better number. And if, in fact, the next thing, which is the potential for a meeting minutes by the Fed to come out a little bit better, more dovish, that could be really impactful for markets. But going down a list of what does this all mean and why are investors probably staying on the sidelines, we also have the continuing geopolitical concerns. They're not shutting down at all. I mean, you look at the discussion from and what happened in Italy and France this weekend and this week, and you have the Brexit, reality that seems to be coming. The China slowdown, the infighting with our country and seemingly everybody else these days, it's not a good thing for the overall psyche of the markets. Then we have the impact of tariffs and the continuation of negative headlines regarding tariffs and how companies are having a very difficult time. The Dems, the Democrats, looking to undo regulatory ease. They're just saying, you know what, you undid all this stuff that's going on that we put into place under Obama, blah, 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 blah. And now they regaining power into the new year. Are they going to really undo some of this deregulation? So they're going to go to re-regulation, I guess what's going to be called. So all these things are creating this incredible wall of worry. And a lot of them are true and factual. And areas that really could blow an just a gigantic hole through our economic growth trajectory. There's no question about that. And we could probably add a few things to this list, right? Probably a few things you're thinking of right now. Probably enough for me right now. Here's the point. All these things were probably led into the last few weeks of a real negative market in overall performance. The spiking VIX, the put-call ratio cropping up above 1.2, the trend surging past 3, to a point that we're getting towards capitulation. I think we have to get through this week. There could be some good things ahead of it, some squaring up, clearly. But if we can get any kind of good news out of any of this, I'd go back to my thought that I had a couple of weeks ago that we could see a year-end rally. Again, all bets are off into 2019 because I think a lot of these things, as long as they play out, are real. And we're going to see some real problems. And as we go through that, if we see some of that, we'll continue talking about protection of your portfolio, how to protect it, what to do. Now, let's talk about Black Friday a little bit, because we did see that some analysts and reports are pointing to a great Black Friday, just an unbelievable Black Friday. And there's a lot more days this year, like maybe two more days this year from the time that Black Friday sales started to Christmas, because of the way that the weeks fell here, it seems. This is what you're hearing. This is what I'm reading. I personally wouldn't read much into this. We see this every year. At least some variation of the same theme. Black Friday sales, really just amazing. It's great. The problem is a lot of discounting going on, more so this year than we've seen in the last couple of years. And there's a group, the Retail Association, that always puts out a positive spin on anything to do with sales, retail sales, and into this season. They do it. I don't buy it. There's one by Adobe, one report that we saw that early indications do show a great result so far by online shopping. And this is as of 10 o'clock on Friday, on Black Friday. And there's not much more. We'll get some more throughout the week. They have to go through the whole thing. They go through Cyber Monday, et cetera. But there was supposedly $643 million worth of online sales that tracked through up to 10 a.m. on Friday, which was up 28% from a year ago. So the question is, are online sales beefing up in such a way that it's going to turn out to be really great for retail establishments this year? Because you add that to maybe their brick and mortar. Or once again, are we going to see that online sales are stealing from the numbers of the brick and mortars? Are they stealing market share? You know, the Amazons and all the other names out there. Are the online sales of the brick and mortar companies stealing share from their brick and mortar sales? So it's just a shift. We'll have to see how that plays out. But again, it looks like it's going to be a pretty good, I think it's going to be a pretty good retail sales season, it would seem likely, except for the fact that markets have tumbled in the last few weeks, setting off a bit of a negative tone. People may be a little bit more reluctant to buy at this point. Okay, so just to sum this up real quick, where do we go from here? Markets are in a corrective tone. There's no question about that. We have this G20 to look forward to in Argentina next week, and we're looking primarily for some kind of cooperation, agreement, framework, discussion, talking points, a wink, a nod, something from President Xi and President Trump on the potential for restarting trade talks and maybe somebody waving the white flag a little bit, or maybe it's a tiny, tiny, little bitty white flag saying, okay, we'll talk about this because this is hurting both of our countries at this point. And there's no reason for us to do that. We want to make sure that both countries are prosperous. Why are we doing this? Now, for those of you that are like, well, the hell with them. They're stealing our intellectual property and they're stealing all sorts of other, you know, business away from us and jobs. And I get it. I agree. but there needs to be some possible slow process to get this resolved, because just cutting off the knees of China does not necessarily help us either. I'm not willing to burn down the house here to get what we want. Maybe we could torch the kitchen and leave the rest of the house, but not the whole house. We're going to see on Tuesday the Case-Shiller housing report along with consumer confidence come out. Oftentimes I find that to be a bit of a positive day because it's window dressing, end of month, a couple of days into before the end of the month ends, and oftentimes you see a little bit of that go on. Second quarter's estimate for GDP on Wednesday. Again, we're seeing a consensus that shows about 3.6% versus 3.5% from the first look. FOMC minutes on Tuesday. Or is that Thursday? I think it's Thursday. We're going to see the FOMC minutes come out with the Fed hopefully signaling a little bit more dovishness here. The last parade of Fed officials came out and talked about that, and they seem to be a little bit more dovish. We see income, spending, important PCE prices, the Fed's favorite inflation gauge as well. So that's what's happening next week. Let's see how this all plays out from a bit of what we would look at as some panic selling that could continue into Monday, no question about it. And if we do see that, I'll be looking for some gap downs to pick up for some opportunistic pricing buys on Monday morning. All right, let's get to some listener questions. And I mentioned before that now through the end of the year, we're going to be reading some of these listener questions on the air. And we will pick one random listener question, totally random, and we'll send them a copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, which you could also grab on Amazon Audible. Listen to it like a podcast. It's available for you over there. Great gift for the holiday season. Timeless piece. That's the way I wrote it. So it doesn't matter if it was written last year or 20 years ago. It's all the same basic information that you need to know about how to invest, what to look for, key components, fundamental analysis, technical analysis, quantitative analysis, even a whole chapter on fixed instruments like guaranteed investment contracts and annuities, how to uncover great stocks, etc. So anyway, let's get to these questions. And the first question comes in from Michael Pugh, and he says, Andrew, hey, thanks for your podcast. I'm a fairly new listener, but have quickly become hooked. That's the way we like it. I'm emailing you because I'm interested in evaluating a portfolio risk over historic periods and would like to know what methods you think are best. My goal is to find an all-weather portfolio, one that has low risk while maintaining good performance in any market, which, by the way, not possible, but reasonable performance on a relative basis is possible. Let me just say that point. So he says, in terms of evaluating risk, what are the best measures to use in my case? I'm an engineer, and in my free time, I have been working on developing a home-baked program that will allow me to quickly and easily test different allocations over time. Thanks for the show. All right, so Mike, here's the deal. So a couple of things you want to look at, and I'll mention this right up front. We did a report on evaluating fixed income from the aspect of passive and active investing. So we looked at the two sides of the way you can invest. There's a few different ways, but basically with ETFs and with mutual funds for fixed income. And in that, some of the core components of what you want to look at are there. So I'm going to put a link to that report in the show notes for episode number 589 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you hadn't written that report, a little bit lengthy, but you need to read that report. It's pretty surprising some of the results you'll see. But some of the things we looked at, and I also put definitions of this in that report, are standard deviation of historical returns. And you have to be careful not to data mine any of this, okay? So just look at a 10-year. We did some 3-year rolling returns. Look at a 20-year if you can. Look at standard deviation. Historical downside risk. What's the worst case scenario at any given market condition? How your portfolio played out over that period of time? And you want to look at things like the Sharpe ratio. So when you're building a portfolio, what's my Sharpe ratio of each individual security? How does it work well with it? And make sure that you put in some diversification. There's different ways to do this. Now, when you create this portfolio, what you want to look at is all of these, like standard deviation of the portfolio, historical downside risk of the portfolio, total Sharpe ratio of the portfolio. These are risk reward statistics and can give you an idea of, okay, what's my worst case scenario? Now you're trying to, because you're trying to build an all weather portfolio. And when you do that, you want to look at really the aspect of risk and return together. So if you put those into your calculations and then look at that over various periods of time, and you can do this if you're good at Excel, you can bring that kind of information up, or you can look on Morningstar.com. There's different ways. And there's even some online resources that you can use that will allow you to plug in this information and look at all the results. YCharts is one that we use. You have to pay for it. But YCharts, depending on what subscription level you get, you could probably do a lot of that research in there. The next question comes from, I'll mention, by the way, if you do want to submit a question and you do want a chance at winning the book, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and just ask your question. Very easy to do. This comes from Caleb Mahler. He says, thanks for the podcast, longtime listener. I realize corporate debt is at an all-time high, and it's possible the next recession can very well be related to this fact. I'm wondering, if this is the bond market, how could one profit from this? Would one go long bonds or short bonds? Does this have anything to do with treasuries? Bonds have always been an area of confusion for me. All right, so, you know, it's interesting because bonds, a little bit different than stocks, but bonds have a lot more movement that could be attributable to outside influences like rating services, yes, recessions, and of course the Fed. You look, for example, at what went on over the last number of years over in Europe, where the European Central Bank decided, you know what? We're going to be buying bonds because we want to reduce rates. We want to reduce rates so much that it's almost ridiculous to a point of doing anything but investing in stock markets. We want to prohibit essentially companies from doing anything but issuing debt, and at such a great level because it's so cheap that they push money into the economy, create liquidity, loan money out, create expansion, capital expenditures, etc. So while, yes, I agree, what will happen is in a recession, could you in fact benefit from bonds? I think if you look at what the Fed does during recessions, they lower rates. Therefore, oftentimes the greatest movement of rates and of bonds, I should say, happen at the long end of the fulcrum. Think of bonds as a fulcrum. You have a short end and a long end, and the longer end moves a lot bigger. The movement point is to the left of the short bond. So any little bit of movement of bonds usually will affect long bonds in a much greater sense. So if there is, first, let's talk about this in a different sense. If there is a, quote, bond market collapse, you probably want to be in the long bonds. You want to be in junk bonds on the short side. Okay? Bond prices will go down. People sell off bonds. They don't want to deal with that. They sell the longies. On the other hand, you have to ask, if we have a recession, will the Fed come back in and start buying bonds? And as such, you just want to follow them and then buy bonds, not go short. It's a problem. It's a problem because, yes, bonds do sell off rather dramatically during economic stress periods. And you'll see already that stress level is starting to increase as junk bonds are starting to sell off. You can see things in, for example, symbol JNK, which is a junk bond portfolio ETF below investment grade, selling off with the stock market. So if I was to look at, if I wanted to be involved in bonds for whatever reason, not saying I want to, but if I did, and I wanted to get in on profiting on bonds, if in fact the economy falls apart, I would probably look at shorting junk bonds that move with equities most often, where there'll be the most stress because those companies will probably have the least ability to pay back that debt, therefore get credit downgrades. And of course, people will want to stay away from those. So long junk bonds is the play on that. So again, you have to be careful though, because you have both sides of the equation working here, where you can have the Fed in a way working against the failure of bonds because they're buying them. Next question comes from Richard Ansimo. And he says, what would be your best economic indicator to help predict recessions? This is a great question because it's tough. Recessions, there's so much information that goes into the prediction of recession, which most of the time will be wrong. Okay, so that's first of all, it's very difficult to really pinpoint and accurately pinpoint when a recession is going to happen. In fact, it's so difficult that the official recession gauges happen after the recession has already occurred. It's only in the rearview mirror that we can actually see a recession. But one of the things that I would look for is trending GDP trending down. I would look at things like manufacturing indices, the Philly Fed being my favorite to watch very closely. The ISM index of manufacturing and of services below 50 is an important thing. And more importantly, probably an inverted yield curve that may not predict but may cause a recession. So there's a few things that you can look at when you're thinking about what to find in a recession, or how to predict a recession. Last question comes from Asaf Satan, and he says, hey, Andrew, I really enjoyed reading your research, passive or active for fixed income. That's the one I'm going to post the link to on this episode show notes. It sheds some light on this gray area, but I can't understand the divergence in the tips, emerging markets and world fixed income for the 3, 5, 10 year frames. What happened at that time, and how come the pros couldn't handle that better from the passive funds? Thanks. So I think there's something to do with the efficiency of, we'll talk about tips first, the efficiency of the markets when it comes to treasury inflation protected securities. That's the only thing that we could really come up with, that there was a lot of efficiency, and any selling that happened, it just, you know, they were just buying and buying and buying, and possibly there was some over analysis in many of the in any of the actively managed, as well as their fee structure. That was a head scratcher, I'll tell you. For emerging markets in the world, we think it had to do with the currency hedging or non-hedging. That was the main issue there. And don't forget that you also had a significant amount of bond buying in the world area over that period of time. And there may have been a point where analysts were thinking that the valuations were way out of whack and therefore decided to scale back on it. But the central banks, particularly in Europe and the US and Japan, were just buying bonds regardless of valuation. There's a point that you don't want to buy a bond. If a bond that you're going to buy for $100, you're guaranteed to get back $85. No, I'm not buying it. Same thing if you're going to buy that bond at $100 and get back $92, $95. Why am I going to buy a bond to lose money? So you had that going on around the world, and maybe some of these analysts said that the price was too rich and were not desirous of buying those. And possibly they didn't have the ability to short them in any way that was feasible, or maybe even arbitrage, because their fund mandate would allow it. So I think between currency and the potential for inability to accurately judge the risk due to the fact that they were unwilling to take some of that risk that the central banks were just willing to do, probably caused some of that pain there. But I agree. It didn't seem very logical at all because of the fact that there is this general sense that these are inefficient markets. Aside from tips, the emerging markets and the world bonds are somewhat inefficient. So a little bit of a crazy scenario. We'll see if we ever normalize and get the central banks out of this. If that does, in fact, get back to an active management bias, we'll be better for that. So there we go. All right. And we randomly picked... Let me see. I got this written down somewhere. Nope. That's interesting. Okay. What happened to it? Here we go. Got it. We randomly picked Michael Pugh as the winner of the book this week, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. Michael, do me a favor. Send us, email us, write us, call us, do something. Get us your address so we can send you a book this week. And for the rest of you, please do me a favor. Keep on sending in the questions. I appreciate it. And we'll go from there each and every week through the end of the year, giving away a book. We're going to end it right there. I hope you have a great weekend, a great time with your family, friends, weather, more turkey after that. Some great, really, turkey mishmash recipes, turkey pot pie, turkey, whatever it's going to be. And I'll see you next. It's not confirmed yet. It's on the edge of confirmation, but we have a great guest coming up next week that's going to talk about a great book that was actually a listener recommendation. I got the author on, and I hope he's there. I don't want to say it if he's not, but a guy named Arthur Herman, who wrote a book called Freedom's Forge, fascinating book on America's business, the American businesses, their overall place in World War II, and basically with how they not only helped, but they were the winners and the reasons why we actually won World War II. A fascinating story. Thanks for joining me. Otherwise, and I'll see you again next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.